May the Sith be with you. We have a quorum to conduct business today with Senator Baggage, Vice Chair Hughes, Senator Zello, and Senator Reinbold with us today. Please remember to silence your cell phones. We're in 205 of the Petrovich. We have two items of business before us. We have SB 191 from Senator Reinbold, the repeal of COVID disaster emergency, and we also have to consider amendments to take the will of the committee. And then our second item of business is to consider amendments in the will of the committee for HB 392, expand advanced practice nurse physician authority by Representative Snyder. First, we will take up SB 191 from the Senate. From the sponsor, is here at the table with us. And is there any other questions from committee members to the bill sponsor before we start amendments?
Mine is actually for the department. I just wanted to clarify a couple of questions that we asked last week.
Yes, and I believe the department is coming to the table.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
So my first question is, the question was asked at the last meeting about the SNAP benefits and what would be the impact of the SNAP benefits. And I had asked you this just a moment ago, but if you wouldn't mind sharing that with, should this bill pass, what would be the impact on SNAP benefits for the state at present?
Sure. Through the chair, Matt Davidson. I'm a special assistant to the commissioner from the Department of Health Services. My understanding is that due to the state's PHE declaration, public health emergency declaration, SNAP has enabled for an additional $7.6 million a month in supplemental benefits to Alaskans.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So the reason I'm asking it that way, you know, Mr. Davidson, is but the federal government guarantees those SNAP. So what is the trigger then that ensures that that extra benefit comes to the state? What's the actual trigger? And does it require, and I remember this, Mr. Chairman, you were debating this issue in Finance Committee. I was listening very closely to the conversation at the time, and there seemed to be a connection between the declaration and the trigger. And so I just wanted to be clear that we have to have a concomitant declaration to receive the federal funds. Is that your recollection?
That is my understanding through the chair, that the state needs to be under a public health emergency in order for those supplemental benefits to be implemented.
Okay. All right. Yes, Senator Reinbold?
First of all, you said that's your understanding. That's not clarity. So my understanding is, why should we have to be in a public health emergency if the federal government tells us all for – and how many people are actually getting in? Are these enhanced SNAP benefits? And how many people does this impact?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I'll have to get back to you with the actual numbers, but my understanding is that it's necessary in order to receive. Yes, they are supplemental benefits.
So with that, we do have one amendment from Senator Baggage. Oops, one more question, Matt.
It's not clarity at all.
Leave yet? Sorry. Senator Hughes.
Sorry, was processing. So I want to get that monthly amount again. I think was it 7 million?
My understanding is 7.6 million approximately per month.
Okay, so we've all seen grocery prices go up, inflation hitting across everything, fuel prices. Have there been any adjustments because of that currently?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm not aware of any adjustments due to inflation to SNAP. This was an enhancement due to the federal disaster.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Reinbold.
So can you say with certainty, yes or no, the state has to be an emergency for this, these whatever number that for some crazy reason you don't know how many people this impacts. Did the state, yes or no, has to be in a state of emergency? Because I thought the federal emergency, it's federal funds, and I thought it was covered with that. Not that I support. I think it's a complete abuse and misuse of power to keep the state in a state of emergency so some people can get SNAP benefits is literally lunacy. So I don't support it fundamentally. So regardless, but I don't want it to be, it's my understanding. I want clarity. Does the state have to be an emergency? Because both the Attorney General and someone else said we're keeping us in the state of Alaska in a state of emergency, which means emergency use stuff like PCR tests and emergency vaccines and emergency this and emergency that can be done. And so it's impacting Alaskans' lives across the state. And if the only reason is for X number of people to get enhanced, not SNAP benefits, but enhanced benefits, I fundamentally think it's an abuse of power. So yes or no, does the state have to be in an emergency to get these benefits?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I will get back to the committee in writing with certainty.
Thank you. With that, we have amendment number one, Senator Baggage.
I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of explanation, Senator Baggage.
Thank you, and Senator Reinbold has been good enough to ask me to explain lines 3 and 4, which I can do. And so this is only a two-line bill, and so these amendments should be very clear. The first one is it would take out, as we discussed, sections 9, the references on line 5 to sections 9 and sections 10. Those are the two sections, 9 dealing with the charitable gaming issue and 10 dealing with the school fund maintenance or overage, both of which while they might be addressed in other legislation, that legislation has not passed yet, so we don't want to necessarily unnecessarily impact them. As a consequence of that, the line and 21B-E, so that's B through E, which is the sections of the enrolled law, have to be changed so they only are C and E, because you've just taken 9 and 10 out. By removing section 9 and section 10 from the past law, those are effectively B and D in the reference in the statute. So it's C and E are the only things you would need to delete in this bill affected by the those are the only two sections you'd need to leave in the bill, delete. Those are the only two sections you'd need to repeal from the bill because you already have removed sections 9 and 10. So those are conforming amendments. They're simply to conform with the removal of 9 and 10. They only affect 9 and 10.
Are there questions or further discussion? Senator Reinbold.
I would like to say, yes, I did talk to Ledge Legal about this before. They kept referring me back to what they were instructed to draft. My understanding, when I look at Section 9, it has to do with online gaming, and this is the original when we go back to House Bill 76. And 10 was the operating school funds. So with that, I am going to be supporting this, even though I wouldn't have brought forth this amendment, just out of camaraderie and trying to make sure minority voices are listened to, which I think is important. I will be supporting this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Are there further discussions? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number one? Hearing none, amendment number one passes for SB 191, which brings the bill back before us. Is there final discussion or comments from committee members on Senate Bill 191? Senator Reinbold, do you want any closing comments?
I think I've made myself very clear, Mr. Chairman. I've been troubled since basically March 10th or 11th when the governor declared the emergency. I felt like 30 days was plenty. I, as you all know, I tried to strip his powers way back in May of 2020. I think there's been tremendous overreach, and I think it's actually the mandates on a local, federal, and state level have actually created a far bigger disaster than COVID itself. And so I think this is of critical importance. And basically all this bill does is it strips what I believe is illegitimate, illegal, unconstitutional powers from the Commissioner of Public Health, Adam Crum. And I have no justification of why we are still in emergency. The department has failed to answer my questions, basically for the last 2 years, the vast majority of my questions, with actual real research. They've just been giving me, you know, talking points from a federal agency, which is completely unacceptable. I'm a passionate believer in state rights. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to have heard this bill. I wish it would have been heard a lot earlier so we could actually have time to work it in the House, but I am thankful at this point in time to ask for people's support in regards to this very simple piece of legislation. Thank you.
We'll take the will of the committee. Senator Hughes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 191, version 32-LS1491/I as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 191 as amended has passed the committee. We'll take a brief at ease to do the documents. We are back on the record. Our next item of business this afternoon is HB 392, the Expand Advanced Practice Registered Nurse and Physician Assistant Authority, sponsored by Representative Snyder. We do have Rep. Snyder online, and her trustee staff is also in the room as well to answer any further committee members' questions. We are also going to consider a possible amendment, and with that, Rep. Snyder, do you have any comments you would like to make before we begin our amendment process?
Sure. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had spoken out of committee that there may be value in me walking the committee through the regulations that we have in place regarding DNRs and the process by which those are ordered and implemented, as well as drawing a distinction between DNRs and advanced health directives and the POLST form, along with possibly highlighting the impact of Section 10, which did not receive much treatment in the first hearing. And it does provide some additional, control of the patient on the side of the patient that we didn't fully recognize during the last committee. I'm happy to address any of those if helpful, but also here to stand by if you wish to move forward.
Would like to have those items addressed from committee members? Yes, please go ahead, Rep. Snyder.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know much of our focus has turned to Section 5 with respect to the Do Not Resuscitate order. That's where the language now requires written consent of the patient or the parent or guardian of a minor patient. Section 10 also, this is 1352.100. This does explicitly state that a patient has the right to make their own health decisions if capable and can revoke a DNR order that may be made by a physician if this bill passes, as well as an APRN or a physician assistant. So when we heard from a healthcare professional at the first committee hearing, this is what she was referencing, that we already have protections in statute where a patient can undo that order if they are capable of doing so. That said, I think it's also helpful to understand the process of the DNR protocol. So if you look at 1352.065B, it directs the department shall by regulation adopt a protocol subject to the approval of the state medical board for do not resuscitate orders and setting out a standardized method of procedure. So what that protocol actually does is, and that's for your reference, it's AAC 16.010. And what happens is if an individual comes in to a healthcare facility, the healthcare provider first has to determine the patient identity. That's the first step. They can do that by asking the patient if they're able to respond. They can look at a driver's license, a medical bracelet, or a medical necklace, or some other medical information card that they may carry with them. It's also possible that they could determine identity through the provider might have seen them once before, or they may be accompanied by someone who can attest to their identity. Once that the patient's identity is determined, then the provider must examine the patient, must review medical records, and then also, again, if they hadn't already utilized it to identify the patient, look to see if there's a medical bracelet, necklace, or card that identifies their DNR status. The patient, if they're awake, can provide the DNR status. The healthcare provider can look up a department-approved DNR form that may be on file or look for one. Or there's also the POLST form, which we have heard about, which is the physician's order for life-saving treatment. That is a form that, by requirement, is filled out in consultation between the patient and the healthcare provider, documenting what they would want to do if they were in a position where a DNR is in question. It is correct. It is true that the POLST form, the patient signature is voluntary. We've heard from medical professionals there's a reason for that, because there may be instances in which a patient cannot physically sign a POLST form. So it is there, but it is meant to be done in consultation. Or an attending physician can assess the patient and make it a determination whether a DNR order is appropriate. It is important to note that according to this protocol that is in regulation, that CPR must be administered until items 1 and 2 have been worked through and confirmed. So that is our current issue. And yes, it is still true, without the passage of 392, it is possible that, and we hear some stories about a physician ordering a DNR without consultation with the patient. And that can happen in some instances where the consultation is just not possible. You are in an acute situation it's not a situation where the patient has been ill for some time and they know that they are in their end stages of life. This is more in the case where someone is taken to the emergency room, for example. With Section 5 written as is now in 392, written consent is required no matter what. And I think what has happened in Section 5 now has fixed one issue, and an important issue, making sure that patients, whenever humanly possible, or their surrogate or their guardian, is making an informed decision on a DNR order. We have made it impossible for medical professionals to respond in some of these other acute instances where that consent process is just not possible. I think one example that we hear very commonly that we would also want to avoid is, say, an elderly individual coming in to the emergency department. It's possible that you could conduct CPR, but given their physical status, performing CPR is going to cause internal damage, could possibly cause brain damage, and what you're doing is you're not really saving their life. What you're doing is creating a situation where they are going to die in a more painful way now. That is one example of concern that we have heard from medical professionals. So if there is a way that we can find to ensure that consent, when possible, is obtained and documented, and if it's not possible, then we do have, as I just outlined a moment ago, a pretty detailed process in our DNR protocol laid out in regulation. And I think I'll leave it there, and I'm happy to assist in the conversation however I can.
All right. Thank you. We do have a question from Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and I was trying to follow, and then you referred to they had to go through items 1 and 2. So can you tell us again if there's an acute situation and they're attempting to resuscitate, there's not a response, they determine that they're going to need to stop, they don't have a family member, what is the protocol that they go through? You referred to something as items 1 and 2, and I didn't know what items 1 and 2 were.
So it's that process where the DNR protocol is that first they have to identify the patient. Second, they have to determine whether there's already documentation of a DNR order or the absence thereof, whether there's a post form, for example, which is one way to document the desire to receive CPR or not receive CPR. And in the absence of any of those things, then yes, according to regulations, a physician could make the determination that issuing a DNR order in that acute situation is the appropriate thing to do.
Senator Hughes?
Yeah, I'll just say I think this is a pretty heavy subject that may need to be readdressed at a future time, because I understand ERs are very busy places, a lot of pressure, the next patient walking in the door and the availability of the ER physicians, but I does concern me that one person not gone through the items 1 and 2, the identity, whether there's a form, and then the doctor can just decide. I'd rather see it be the consultation of several physicians coming to an agreement rather than putting on the shoulder of one, but that's kind of beyond this bill at this point. I know we're just really, this started out so that nurse practitioners and PAs could be able to sign off on these items along with physicians, since they pretty much do what physicians do otherwise. So I do think it's worth exploring, Mr. Chair, in the future. It does seem like a pretty – I'd like to talk to some physicians at some point, maybe over the interim, because it seems like a lot of power vested in one individual, whether to stop trying to save a person's life or not, if there's no form, there's no family member. So I just wanted to get that on the record.
Any further questions for Representative Steiner? Senator Reinbold.
I just want to say I think Senator Hughes actually has an important
point, especially with COVID and the lack of advocacy in the rooms. And after all the listening sessions I have heard, it is heart-wrenching to hear the stories of what happened. I mean, some people are just absolutely appalled at what's been going on in these hospitals and the lack of early intervention. And I've heard some pretty unbelievable stories, and I actually think that it needs to be investigated. The bottom line here is I think you have a very important point that does need to be looked at, especially when the mandates were blocking people from having advocacy. And then in the other body, when they tried to get a patient advocacy, the bill was killed on the floor by Bryce Edgman. There's something very suspicious about this. So the bottom line is I just want to thank Senator Hughes for bringing this up. And if we have an opportunity, I'd like to work with you on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further conversation? Seeing none, thank you, Rep. Snyder. We do have a possible amendment. Senator Casella, we could take an at ease here to distribute this. We are back on the record. We do have amendment number one, Senator Casella.
I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of conversation, Senator Casella.
Thank you. So what we have learned is that there is a form, and it is called the POLST form. It is the physician order of life-sustaining treatment. And we have learned that this form is filled out between a physician and the patient in consultation with each other. We know that the form is placed in a national database so that when, God forbid, somebody goes into the emergency room, the healthcare professionals will go online to determine whether or not this individual has previously sat down with their physician and made the decision about whether or not to have a do not resuscitate instruction or order. So it's my understanding that the intention of this section is to give more decision-making to the patient. And so I believe this amendment is in the spirit of the entire section, because what it does is it removes the word written. The reason it removes the word written is because the POLST form does not require the patient to sign it. It is a voluntary signature, and there is also a line on that form for a witness. So if we keep the word written in here, we now are going to essentially negate every single POLST form that Alaskans have had submitted. And so I think when you weigh the benefit of respecting that conversation that the Alaskan has had with their physician in this form that is online, we can still keep the intent of the section by keeping the word consent, which it does. So you still are getting the consent, and by virtue of getting rid of the word written, you allow the POLST forms to be viable forms, and you also require the healthcare professionals to get consent from the patient. So I feel comfortable that this amendment satisfies the intent of the section and also allows for the POLST forms to be respected, which I think is very important that we keep that as a viable communication that the patient has made with their doctor and is communicating, broadly through this form.
Thank you. Is there any further conversation? Senator Hughes.
And I don't know if the sponsor of the amendment knows just how practically it works. So I come into the hospital, I have scheduled surgery, and they're reviewing paperwork work with me in advance, and then perhaps I'm not in a position to sign, physically sign at that point. After they're required to have a conversation with me, and then if I give them, you know, yes, I agree, then they upload it to this database, and that stays in the database until such time as I would want to remove it. Is that how it works? I'm just not familiar. I don't believe I've ever been presented the opportunity to do a pulse form, so I just was wondering how it works.
Taking at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Baggage.
Thank you. I just want to, for the record, for some clarity on what a pulsed form is. First, let me read from the version in Alaska, and 46 states have these forms. Healthcare providers should complete this form only after a conversation with their patient or their patient's representative. The pulsed, P-O-L-S-T, decision-making process is for patients who are at risk for a life-threatening clinical event because they have a serious life-limiting medical condition and may include which may include advanced frailty. I think the goal is to put the form, which we have here in front of us, on basis, and then the further description. This is just a general description of POLST forms. So the POLST form is a medical order, which means that the POLST form is always signed by a medical professional, and depending upon the state, the person stated on the form can sign as well. Just for a moment, I would point out that the form here in Alaska is optional for the patient to sign, which is to the point of the amendment. Further, a pragmatic rule for initiating a POLST can be, as ours states, can be if the clinician would not be surprised if the individual were to die within 1 year. One difference between a POLST form and an advanced directive is that the POLST form is designated to be actionable throughout an entire community. It is immediately recognizable and can be used by doctors and first responders, including paramedics, fire departments, police emergency rooms, hospitals, and nursing homes. So hopefully that helps clarify things.
Thank you. Senator Casella.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Begich, for that. So just to clarify, this is a medical order. It is not a legal document such as an advance directive. And then I think it's very important for the public to know also that there is a section here. It says pick one. Yes, CPR, attempt resuscitation, including medical ventilation, mechanical ventilation, defibrillation, and cardioversion, or no CPR. So you check one or the other. Do not attempt resuscitation. So we're not just talking about a form where a person wants to do not resuscitate. We are talking about a form that allows the individual to give their desires should they be incapacitated. So I just wanted that to be on the record also.
Thank you, Senator Casella. Senator Hughes.
I also want on the record that it does allow for a patient representative. So, a family member or someone's designated as a representative too. So if a person is incapacitated, it allows for that.
Thank you. Any further conversation on amendment number one? Seeing none, I will remove my objectives. Are there further objection to amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one passes, which brings us back to HB 392. Is there further amendments? Further conversation? We'll see the will of the committee. Senator Hughes?
I have one comment before I make the motion. I have been very impressed in our state with physician assistants and advanced practice registered nurse, which I tend to call nurse practitioners, although no, that's just one category. But they have assumed greater responsibility in the state and really have improved access to health care and greater affordability for health care. And so I think it does make sense to include them. The training they now receive is becoming more comparable to what physicians receive. It's maybe not quite as many years, but it's pretty extensive, and they really do meet a need in our state. So I think it's appropriate that we add them to be able to do this. So with that, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 392, version 32-LS1561/B.A. as amended from committee with individual recommendation attached to fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, HB 392 as amended has passed from committee. And just stick around here as we pass around the documents. So just want to thank everybody for today's and this session's committees. We do have committees planned for next week, just as placeholders, just previously bill scheduled and heard. But we also want to thank Ms. Mary Gwynn for being our recorder from Senate, our recording secretary, and all the LIO monitors that we've had over the couple of years of being here of the HES committee. With that, I'll leave any other closing comments from any other committee members. Senator Reinbold.
Just also wanted to, I think you might have mentioned Jasmine. She's been really efficient and easy to work with. So thank you for hiring good staff, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And thanks for Ms. Simpson and Ms. Martin for being with us this past session. Another comment, Senator Begich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you for, again, we may have another hearing, who knows, but if this is the last hearing of the committee, thanks for running the committee again for how many years in a row has it been? Six, the sixth year. So great job. Lots of legislation passed through here. A lot of it's becoming law. So thank you for that. And thanks to Lukey Tobin, my staff, who's helped me actually navigate this.
All right.
Oh, it's my turn. I actually avoided this committee initially because I had come from this background and I wanted to learn about other things in the state. But I have enjoyed being on it and coming back and touching base on some of these things. It's been good. And I do think, and I didn't know that Jody was working behind the scenes on this committee. So I want to thank her and Jasmine too. And to my new staff who just kind of stepped in, and this has been a learning process, Brent Bartlett. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Sello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, with that, we are adjourned at 2:16 p.m. Have a great day.